Welcome to the Classic City Sports Podcast.
And McAllister down the left field line. Connor Tate is going to round third. He will score. And rounding third is Blaylock. He will score. And the Dogs rock it off.
If you're looking for the latest Georgia Bulldog news in football, basketball, baseball, and recruiting, then you are in the right place.
It's third down. Bryce Young's career. You need 10. Play clock at 4. From the pocket. Launching downfield. Underthrown and intercepted. Keeley Ringo has an escort down the sidelines. All the way to the end zone. And Georgia is going to conquer the Crimson Tide.
Hosted by Jeremiah Stoddard and Jonathan Williams.
Georgia on the mountaintop. Demons be gone and the drought is over. National champions at long last.
Just sit back, relax, and prepare yourself for these hot takes you're about to listen to.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Classic City Sports. As always, Jeremiah Stoddard and Jonathan Williams. We have an action-packed episode for you, like we have every single week during this off-season as well. So come join us. And Colonel Sanders, I see your comment. I probably messed that up in the Discord, did I not? I would be willing to bet that I mistyped that in that text a second ago. But we've got a lot to talk about for you guys today. As always, it's off season, but guess what? We've got content for you constantly on Wednesday nights. A lot of stuff to go over. So we're going to start with what can you learn about Georgia? There's a few questions that you can ask and what you can learn about Georgia during this spring ball and spring practice that started up even before the G-Day comes around here in April in a few weeks. And we'll get deep into that. Then we promised you guys this a couple weeks ago that we were going to cover this. We are going to do offensive line as far as our breakdown, a position breakdown that we are doing, a position every single episode. We're doing something like that for the entire offseason until we run out of positions to do. Offensive line will be covered today. Then, as always, King of the Hill at the end of it. Not going to spoil what that is, but stay tuned for the end of the episode for that. Jonathan, let's go ahead and jump straight to you. What can we learn about Georgia this spring? That's the question.
Well, you know, it may seem like there's not a whole lot that you can learn from Georgia. And when I say that, when I ask the question of like, what can we learn about Georgia this spring, I'm kind of talking about things that we can learn from Kirby Smart himself. And, you know, a coach that is going into his eighth year at a program, a coach that now has two national titles to his name, two SEC championships, is kind of like, well, there's really not much we can learn. We know what Kirby Smart is. We know what he's capable of. We know that he gets it done on the recruiting trail. We know that he's capable of bringing his team to the top. And we know that he can rise to standards and he can hold his own in this league and can pretty much say that he is the king of college football. Now, we know all of that. But even with all of this time, nearly a decade spent at this program now, there are still some questions that we can kind of ask about Kirby Smart and questions that he needs, in my opinion, to answer during spring. And I think there's three crucial questions that needs to be answered. I'll just go ahead and get right into them. First one, quarterbacks. Quarterback discussion is a huge talking point of this offseason, you know, talking about, is it going to be Carson Beck? Is it going to be Brock Vandegrift? Does Gunnar Stockton maybe make a strong push for it, for the starting role as the season rolls around? But I think the bigger question to ask is, not who, but what. And let me break this down for you when I say that. So this is the first time in Kirby Smart's 8 years as a UGA head coach where he is going to be playing a quarterback that has been developed, been waiting their turn, and has been on the sidelines for the last 2 to 3 years. Think about it. 2016, Jacob Eason earned the starting role as a true freshman. The following year, Jake Fromm took over the starting position his true freshman year after Jacob Eason got hurt in the first game of the season. And then Jake Fromm held that position all the way through 2019. 2020, you started with Dwan Mathis. Then you rolled out with Stetson Bennett. And Stetson Bennett was on the team in 2017, then took a year at a junior college, and then came back to team. So he doesn't really qualify for that term of a guy that waited his term for the last 2 to 3 years at Georgia specifically. And then he held the position from their point out. And you even had JT Daniels take over the spot as well. So you had a lot of movement on the quarterback room. So it's not about who is going to start, but what? What do they look like? What is Carson Beck after 3 years of waiting his turn? What does he look like? Or what is Brock Vandergriff? What does his development behind the scenes look like now as we roll into the fall? So it's not exactly who starts with Georgia, but what? What do they look like? What do they look like when G-Day rolls around? We finally get to see what a purely Georgia-developed quarterback looks like over that three-year span, and a guy that has had to sit on the sidelines and not necessarily gotten to develop through growing pains from a freshman year for the past 3 years. So there's your first one. The second one, what is your why this year? You know, for the first 6 years or so of Kirby Smart's career, it was win a national championship. That's what I'm here to do. That's what I want to do. That's what this team is trying to do, is end that national title drought. Well, you did that the next year. And then the next year, even after you won a national title, there was motivation to win an SEC championship, because all of those players on roster, you know, nobody even had an SEC championship to their name. That was something that Curtis Jackson talked about, that he wanted to do, put numbers on the wall and put an SEC championship on the wall. And then also win back-to-back titles, prove that the first one wasn't a fluke and that Georgia is here to stay on top of college football. Kirby Smart has a knack for creating these little pieces of motivation. He's keeping his guys motivated. You know, last year was about, we are not going to be hunted at the University of Georgia. We are going to be doing the hunting. And they proved that last year. You go undefeated, you win back-to-back titles. He did that. What is your why this year? Now that you, everybody on that roster, aside from true freshmen and transfers, has a national title or even two national titles to their name. So what are you doing to keep those guys motivated? What is your words of wisdom this year? What are you doing with your football program during the springtime to keep them hungry and keep them motivated? Last one, it's all about the offense. You brought in Todd Monken. You know, for those first few years, the offense was a little bit shaky, a little bit. It was consistent. You know, you kind of had a Honda Accord type of offense. You know, a Honda Accord is not very flashy, but it's consistent.
Reliable. It's reliable.
It's reliable. You know, everybody, there's nothing wrong with the Honda Accord. It's going to get the job done on most days, but every now and then you might have a little bit of issue with it. You might have to go get the oil changed a little bit. You might have a James Coley type year, but then you bring in Todd Monken and you get yourself that Lamborghini and you're cruising, you're flashing, you're looking real nice on that offense. You got the keys to everything. Everybody's looking at you like, whoo, that offense is real efficient. That offense is looking good. They're putting up crazy numbers. They're hanging 60 plus points in the national title game. Now, do you get to keep the Lamborghini, or was it just leased? Do you own that Lamborghini now that you have Mike Bobo in here as offensive coordinator when you promote him? Or do you maybe take a step back? What does your offense look like? Is there continuity with this offense? Does the success continue? Those are the three questions that I think Kirby Smart needs to answer this spring. And those are three big things that I think is something to watch for this spring.
Okay. Well, first of all, golf clap to our boy, because that was impressive. That whole little rant there, that was good. I give you credit for that. That was awesome. Let's start with your first one. Let's start at the quarterback position. Let's look at that. We've talked about it a good bit on this show over the past, you know, let's just face it, all the time. We talk about the quarterback stuff all the time because it is a constant conversation. Like you said, there was always question marks around that position of who's going to be the person, you know, who's next in line. There's always been that guy that's, you know, showed up and then showed out, or, you know, all the different moves that he's had to make and like the adversity that we've had at the quarterback room over Kirby Smart's tenure, where everything that started back in the day with the Justin Fields, Jake Fromm, Jacob Eason, all of that stuff, right? We've come a long way from there. What we have now is exactly what you just said, something we have not had at this quarterback position the entire time. And it is somebody, multiple, not even just somebody, multiple people that have been willing to wait their turn. How many Georgia fans that can honestly say, and I know you and I have been saying this for a long time, that we didn't think it was going to happen. We gave them credit for it, but how many people out there said Carson Beck should enter the transfer portal last year? How many people threw him in the transfer portal last year when Stetson Bennett was your quarterback? How many people threw, you know, Brock Vandergriff in the transfer portal, or have at this point thrown Brock Vandergriff in the transfer portal? Guess what? They're both still on the roster. One of those guys, like you just said, I think Carson Beck is entering his fourth season at Georgia, correct? He's a redshirt junior, and Brock Vandergriff is a redshirt sophomore. So he's been there for, this is his third season at Georgia at this point. Most people counted out Carson Beck as soon as Brock Vandergriff got on campus. And guess what? Right now, it looks like Carson Beck is your quarterback at the time being. Like he is... One, he's been there for the long time. He's learned everything he can learn about Georgia. And then he continues to show out in practice last year when he was not getting to start. And then this year so far in spring, his name's being talked about a good bit already. So he is a guy that sat there with his head down and is ready to just work every single day. And guess what? He's getting his chance right now, and he's getting the majority of the first team snaps, first team reps, and he's making the best of it. Like, he's making the most out of that situation. I'm extremely excited to see. I think the question is, like what you said earlier, what does that look like? You have a quarterback that hasn't had a lot of game experience. He's only played in a few games, thrown the ball maybe like 40, 50 times in his career at most at this point. What does that look like when you finally get thrown into the starting lineup? Well, guess what? I think it's going to be fine no matter who your quarterback is, whether it's him or even Brock Vandegrift. If he somehow jumps, you know, Brock, or if he somehow jumps Carson Beck and takes over as a starting quarterback this year, first of all, that means he's absolutely lighting it up, because we know Kirby likes the seniority side of things. And right now, Carson Beck has kept his head down and been quiet. He's really earned his chance to be a starting quarterback this season, in my opinion. What does that look like, though? When you don't get that experience in games as much, and all of a sudden you're just thrown into the starting lineup. Well, guess what? Stetson Bennett did it. I think he did pretty darn well doing that himself. And he was the two-star recruit that was a JUCO transfer back in, that wasn't even on. He was a walk-on at Georgia at first before all that happened. He did pretty well. Y'all don't think that Carson Beck, who has all the measurables that everyone has constantly said that Stetson Bennett was so bad because he didn't have, he's got all the measurables. He's definitely got the arm talent. I don't have any concern about either of the quarterbacks, especially not Carson Beck, if he were to get the starting job tomorrow.
No, I don't think there should be a concern. It's kind of like that conversation that we had when it was up in the air kind of late in the 2021 season about, does Georgia stick with Stetson Bennett or do they roll out JT Daniels kind of later in the year, when JT Daniels seemed like he was getting healthy and he was an option at that point. And you and I just kind of came on here and we're like, does it really matter at this point? Because Georgia clearly has the best defense, probably the best defense that college football has seen in many, many years. And they're going to continue to play that way. And does the quarterback play really change all that much? The offense was cruising. They were looking good. And Stetson Bennett, not to discredit him or anything like that, but Stetson Bennett wasn't being asked to go out there and be the number one athlete in the country every Saturday. He was going in there to do his job, manage the offense, and he did it really well. Obviously, he played really well, and he stepped up in huge moments for Georgia, and he clutched up when he needed to. So it's kind of, I don't want to say it's necessarily on that level of like, does it really matter? Because yes, I think it does matter a little bit when you get into the things of like, okay, well, what is your roster look like if you do end up with Brock Vandegrift over Carson Beck and things like that. But it's extremely talented. That's what I'm trying to say, is you have a lot of options and you have a lot of talent, but from the sounds and things and the looks of things, it does seem like Carson Beck remains the leader of that pack, and he seems to have pretty strong control over that room. But Brock Vandegrift has also still remained to make a strong push for it, which is what you want. You know, what your number two guy, I put that in air quotes because I don't know if you can necessarily label them as that yet, but you want the guy behind the starter to be pushing him. You want to keep pushing him. You want to keep him motivated, keep him locked in every single day to where both guys have to show up, and you better ball out, or else next week your snap count might look a little different. Your runs with the ones might look a little bit different, those type of things. But I think also another thing that plays into this is just offensive weapons in general. You know, something that we've also discussed pretty thoroughly on here is just the amount of options that Georgia has at wide receiver this year, adding in Lovett, Ra-Ra Thomas. You got Arian Smith, Ladd McConkey, Dylan Bell, Marcus Osemi, Jack Saint, all of those guys. Keep on listening.
So you can many, keep on listening. Dudes.
Brock Bowers, Oscar Delp, tight end room is loaded as all get out. I mean, there's so much to work with. Offensive line is really talented. You kept your interior offensive line intact. You're replacing two tackles, but you're replacing them with Ernest Green and Amarius Mims, it looks like right now, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But really, offense is looking really good already. And it's also sounding like Mike Bobo has pretty much made it a really smooth transition into his tenure now as offensive coordinator. Some of the players have kind of already spoken out about that, Brock Bowers being one of them, about it's been really smooth. Terminology is pretty much the same, but there's also a few wrinkles that Bobo throws in there, as any new offensive coordinator would. I said in the article, of like, Georgia's not giving their offense a face plant, but with any personnel change, there has to be some type of change that happens, but it's not going to be this grand, massive change in an offensive scheme-wise. They're going to pretty much stay the same, but Bobo gets to do his own type of thing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you just brought that up, because that was something I was going to talk about as well. Was, you know, it came out, like, he was obviously asked about it. Bowers was asked about the changes and different things. And he said, like, he came out and he said, he was like, he's noticed some differences. Like, there are some differences overall. And at the end of the day, guys, I know that scares some people, because, like, everyone, I saw some people on Twitter talking about it, say Georgia fans, obviously. And they were talking about, it was like, man, Bobo, you got one more chance. That's all you get right now. So, like, don't mess this up. Well, first of all, when Bobo left Georgia, he left it in a very good state. He left it with 41 points a game. Like, he left it as, like, a good offense. It wasn't like he was, you know, I know people weren't exactly happy with some of his play calling, you know, situations. And to an extent, I used to get a little bit frustrated with that back in the day as well sometimes. But guess what? Like, that last year, man, he was putting up points. So he knows how to do it. And I don't take when he says that he sees things are different, I don't take that as a bad thing. That might be, maybe it's a good thing. I don't know, man. At this point, maybe Brock Bowers lines up and they say, just prove you can cover him and just keep on feeding the guy. And there's talk about him getting a lot of action this next season and how much they're going to get him the ball. Like, maybe they just force feed the guy and say, let's see if you have anybody that can cover him.
I mean, why would you not?
That you can stop him.
Yeah, why would you not? You get one more year of him. You are guaranteed
one more year
of Brock Bowers. Yep. Why the heck would you not?
No chance he comes back again for a fourth year.
Why would you not take full advantage of having your last year of having Brock Bowers? And the thing is, too, this year, there's not a Darnell Washington that you have to put on the field, and because you had to put Darnell Washington on the field as well.
He had to be on the field. He was too good to not be on the field.
Had to. And so you have to have Brock Bowers on the field, but this year you're probably not running as much 12 personnel as you did last year. So yeah, it's just Brock Bowers pretty much out there for the most part. And so why would you not force feed him? And when you got guys like Ra-Ra Thomas and Dominic Lovett and all the guys I listed previously about the wide receiver position that can help open things up even more for Brock Bowers, and you take some of that and you make it even more of a disadvantage for the defense and having to make a decision on how they guard Brock Bowers, then yeah, feed the dude, because anytime he touches the ball, good things happen. He's proven that. And and this year is setting up to be a historical year for Brock Bowers. I mean, there's a strong chance that he rewrites a lot of records in the UGA history books and maybe even the college football history books from that position.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's extremely, but we've talked about this for, you know, we talked about it going into last season. And then we obviously, his freshman year, we almost got surprised with it. But, like, can Georgia have another 1,000-yard receiver? Man, I'm telling you what, if somebody's going to do it next year, it will be Brock Bowers.
It's going to be him.
Yeah, it's going to be Brock Bowers. He was 60 yards short of it last year. Mm-hmm. I think he ended up with about 940. And you were sitting there just like on your edge of your seat during the national championship game.
I was in the press box. And you were just like, chunk it to Bowers. Chunk it to Bowers. Come on, man. Just
while they're putting up a 60 burger on freaking, you know, TCU.
And just on Madden easy mode out there. And I'm like, chunk the ball, Kirk.
Good Lord.
Chunk the ball, Kirk.
Absolutely. But I think your quarterback situation in all of this conversation as well, going into the fact that you have Bowers and that, you know, it's a safety net for those guys to where they can focus on him no matter who it is. It's going to be like, I mean, just give him a chance to go up and get the ball. He showed you that he can do it. So give him the chance kind of thing. Force feed him, design a lot of routes for him. He even came out today and said that, heck, he wants to see if he can be more effective in the run game. So we'll see if he gets more jet sweeps or something this year, because he wants to do it. So we'll see how that plays out. End of the day, I don't think, like, there's no reason to worry about your quarterback situation. But what it looks like is I think it's gonna be a plug and play. That to the long, we just talked about this for, you know, 15 minutes almost or whatever it was, but like, or 10 minutes. And long story short, I think it's plug and play. I don't think it's gonna matter who you put in. I know that you got a new offensive coordinator. I know that you got a new quarterback that's been sitting there waiting their turn. I think it's not gonna be a problem. As far as your next question, you know, what's the why? I mean, Kirby Smart came out and said he wants to prove that they're not a one-trick pony. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't want to make it look like he just, like, caught lightning kind of thing. And he wants to show that there's a consistency to it. And I know you and I talked about this before, and you were like, man, everybody on the roster has a championship, essentially. I think you put this in your article that you wrote about the whole situation, was like, man, everyone except the freshmen and the transfers have at least one national championship, and a lot of them have two. So they don't really have, like, you know, they don't have the same craving for it necessarily. But Kirby Smart's going to drill into their mind, hey, we're not like a one and done type thing, or got lucky and we're able to do it twice in a row. We're going to show the world that like we are, as Jock Peterson said, those dudes, you know what I mean? Like we are those guys. We are the dynasty of college football right now. And this is your chance to prove it. And I think that's what he's going to instill into his guys' heads.
Yeah, I think the motivation for this team this year, and something that Georgia can prove, is one, being able to do it with a new quarterback, proving that you can't, like the quarterback position, because Stetson Bennett might just end up being the spark that Georgia's quarterback room needed. Because up until Stetson Bennett took over that position, and really until the 2022 season, it was a little bit up, like it wasn't bad by any means, of course. Georgia did not have any bad quarterback play. Like during Kirby Smart's tenure, Jake Fromm was a great college quarterback. Jacob Eason was pretty solid his year as well. And so, but Stetson Bennett took it to a different level, and it had to, because you don't become a 4,000 yard passer if your quarterback play doesn't step up to another level. So if you do it again with a Carson Beck or whoever else, whoever is that quarterback, if you do it again while also flipping offensive coordinators, then it's safe to say that Georgia is the best. Like, it's probably safe to say that Kirby Smart's the best coach in college football at this point.
Yes.
Go ahead. We'll just call it what it is. You win three in a row and you do it under those circumstances. You're the best coach in college football from that point on until somebody proves it otherwise.
And that's the point. Like it's, and to clarify what you're saying to everybody else, it is the best current coach in college football. Nobody is arguing that Nick Saban is the greatest college football coach of all time right now. Like, I don't think anyone would. This is a Georgia page. I get it. And we're Georgia fans ourselves. The dude is the GOAT right now. That's fine. As he is the greatest of all time as far as college football coaches go. But that does not mean he is the greatest active coach right now in this very moment. He doesn't necessarily have the best team or the best like unit, and he definitely doesn't have the dynasty stuff that Georgia has going on right now. If Georgia could knock down three in a row, if they could hit a three-peat, man, there's no question.
I don't think a three-peat has happened since Minnesota did it in the 1940s, to put that into perspective. Like, if Georgia did that, there's an argument to be made that that is the greatest dynasty ever built. If you win three in a row, you do something that hasn't been done since freaking one of the world wars was going on. Yeah, there's a freaking argument to be made for that. Absolutely. So that's your motivation right there. You've been historical. You've been doing historical things. How about you go and do something that probably and maybe will not ever be done ever again in college football? Because once that 12-team playoff starts up, Lord, it was already hard to repeat once. It's going to be really freaking hard to do it in a 12-team playoff format. So
I don't know. Maybe it's easier to make the playoffs.
Maybe, but at the same time, you know, you're adding more teams, more games. There's a lot more that could happen.
You do add more games, but it's, you know, and I'm not trying to say, like, you know, just completely sidetrack the conversation. But when you go to a 12-team playoff and you got teams like Georgia and Bama in there, you don't have to worry about them being the 5-team and not being able to get in, even though they're definitely one of the better teams in the country. They get in, they can go play against, you know, the scrub teams that are going to be at 12 through like 8.
Georgia going to be at 60 in the first round or something stupid.
Every top four, even TCU would go out there and hang 60 on a team or something like that. Now they might give up a lot of points or something too, but don't get me wrong.
You know what would be like, funny?
It might be easier to go back to back.
You know, I think this would be pretty hysterical I'll say this, and we can switch over to the offensive line conversation, is if the first year that the 12-team playoff happens, and, you know, I know that there's byes in there or whatnot, but, like, say the first two games that, like, Georgia, Alabama, and Ohio State get together, it would be hysterical if all three of those teams just said, to heck with these unwritten rules. We're scoring and scoring and scoring and scoring until that final whistle is blown.
Let's prove a point.
And those games are like 65-7, 58-14, those types of scores, and just prove like, y'all ain't doing nothing. The big names are here, and we're going to continue to stay here, and it runs through us. I don't care if you get an Iowa at number 12. We're going to rock their crap in the first round and prove to you like, this ain't doing nothing. This is not going to change who we are, and this isn't going to change who the dynasties in this league are, and it dang sure ain't going to do much more revenue for you when we're blowing them out 60-0 in the other rounds, just like it was happening in the first round to begin with.
Well, here's the thing, too. Like, give it 5 years and you're going to see the same handful of teams, right? In the final four. The question mark is going to be like, can we get new teams in there? Well, guess what? We've been getting a couple new teams in the final four every once in a while anyways over the past few years. But when you do it like this, you're going to get in the next 5 years, let's see how many times, you know, Georgia is in the final four. How many times Ohio State is in the final four. Bama is in the final four. A team like Clemson in general, they haven't been as great lately, but they can get into the final four. Your Michigans out there are going to be in the final four still. Like, it. Let's just sit back and after 5 years and go, man, it's the same freaking teams anyways. What are you, like, why? We did this to get the same teams in there. It's not going to matter because everyone wants to understand or wants to believe that you can have the type of magic and everything that you can have in college basketball with a 64-team playoff. ESPN just put out a freaking article the other day talking about what college football would have looked like with a 64-team playoff. Okay, nobody wants to watch that in college football. It's not the same. We're not talking about five guys on a court that can all of a sudden get hot shooting. We're talking about a roster of 85 scholarship players and 120 players total on a team. You're not going to have five guys get hot all of a sudden and just light it up and win games. It's not going to work like that. That's not how football works.
FDU is not running up into the 12-team playoff and upset number one Georgia. That is not happening on the football field. I can promise you that. But we'll go ahead and shift on in the offensive line conversation because we promised it last week and we ran out of time because we were doing what we just did and we rambled on a topic for 25 minutes and we got crunched for time. So we're going to go ahead and give it to you guys. As I stated before earlier in the show, Georgia maintained their interior offensive line. You got a big return from Cedric Van Praan. It looked like he might go to the NFL draft, and now he's coming back for a fourth year. That's a huge piece for Georgia at center. He's a dog. He's a bulldozer up front. He keeps things in check up front. That's a great thing to have, especially with a new quarterback rolling in. You got a guy with the IQ like Cedric Van Praan calling up shots. Those are all great things. And then you also keep Tate Ratledge as well, and you got Xavier Truss on the left side. So all good things. Now it's just about the tackles, but you got some really good tackles to work with. You got Ernest Green, who's looking like he's probably going to end up being your left tackle. He's coming into his sophomore year. Big old dude. He's going to play really well. And then you go to the right side, Amarius Mims, a guy that was at one point in the transfer portal before last season, was looking like he was probably going to end up at FSU, and now he's still a dog. He came back, and he's going to get his playing time this year, looking like at right tackle. But there's still a lot of names. A lot of good names. Georgia has they have a lot of names in that room that are all fighting for playing time, which what makes this spring so interesting because it really boils down to your two tackles, but there's some guys fighting for some spots at the guard spots. You know, guys like Dylan Fairchild, Micah Morris, those two guys, a lot of good buzz coming about around those two names in spring practice early on. People have said that Dylan Fairchild is the strongest human that they have ever seen in their existence. That's a great thing to hear about a guy that just likes to get down, get dirty up front. Austin Blaschke, as Rudes points out in the comments, that's another name. Yep. He's getting some work in over there at tackle. Well, so you got Amarius Mims and all those guys rotating in, getting their reps at practice. So the good thing is, and it's a good thing that you're rotating a lot because, as I said, you have a lot of names and you got a lot to work with and you're figuring things out. So a lot of good stuff coming out of there, and it's really just – I think you're going to be fine at tackle regardless. It hurts, of course, losing a guy like Broderick Jones, who's just a freak human being who can do things that most humans cannot do, and a Warren McClendon who's just – he's consistent, and he consistently gets the job done for you. Those are valuable pieces to have on an offensive line. But you got some new names, and they're going to be really good names, and you got some future Sunday guys going on as well.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and – you mentioned a bunch of names in passing there. The two deep, I'm going to read off the 10 guys in the two deep real quick for everybody listening. So you got Amarius Mims, Micah Morris, Xavier Truss, Dylan Fairchild, Cedric Van Praan, Austin Blaschke, Tate Ratledge, Jared Wilson, Ernest Green, Chad Lindbergh, like all these guys. And then there's some, you know, Monroe Freeling just came on campus who's supposed to be a dude. There's other guys out there as well. That are young, that are going to get their chance. But one thing we have seen on the offensive line of Georgia over the past few years, especially with Kirby in general, is you might sit on the bench for a couple seasons before you get your chance. But guess what? When you finally get your chance to do it, you can be a one-year and done guy and still potentially go in the first round or in the top three rounds of the NFL draft by having one season to do it. And one name that you brought up that I want to talk about right now as well is Amarius Mims. Last year, before the season started, he was all but transferred to Miami or FSU, one or the other. Mm-hmm. And like all of a sudden, they talked him into coming back and he ended up being here. And guess what, man? He is about to start. I mean, this year, like you give him that. And like he's probably going to be a starter this year as one of your tackle positions. And I think it's going to be really, I know we were kind of like talking about there's battles and stuff. I think it's going to be really, really hard to keep him out of one of your two tackle spots this year. But I'm so excited about this room because we've been watching these guys, you know, get recruited and we're sitting there staring at their names going, hey, this guy's a guy. He's going to be able to do something. And then you don't hear about him for 2 years. And all of a sudden they pop back up out of nowhere. And guess what? Like I said earlier, they get 1 year to start and all of a sudden they're on their way to a top, you know, a top three round draft pick, maybe even a first round draft pick, just by getting one full season at Georgia. That's all it takes right now.
I think Broderick Jones did a lot of good service for Georgia's offensive line room because, you know, he hadn't played his full season when Amarius Mims hit the transfer portal, but he played in the national title game against Alabama.
He did.
And after that national title game, there's a lot of people talking about Broderick Jones, and people were already talking about, like, that's the next one right there. That's the next tackle that everybody's going to be itching after when the NFL draft rolls around in 2023. And here we are. He's staring down becoming a top 15 pick in this year's NFL draft. He did a lot of good things for Georgia's offensive line room because it proved, like you said, you may not play for the first 2 years, and it may seem like that you are probably deserving of that starting role, that you probably are better than Jamari Sawyer, or you probably are better than Warren McClendon. But when we do get you in there, when you do wait your turn and you get that full season and you go out there and post zero sacks in 15 games, then yeah, people are going to be talking about you. And when you go up to Indianapolis and you test the NFL combine and they're like, holy crap, that dude moves like that. He bends like that. He's that technically sound. He's that clean with his footwork. Yeah, people are going to be talking about you and you are going to get paid at the end of the day. That is going to happen for you. So I think Broderick Jones helped out Georgia in that area of things on the offensive line a lot. And I think it just kind of speaks to what they're trying to preach to those kids of, like, we understand, like, you probably do deserve to be out there, but we just simply can't do that. Because, you know, offensive line isn't one of those positions where every six plays or every 15 plays, you can switch guys in and out and give somebody else a run. It's not exactly a position where you can do that at. You just got to kind of stick with your guys, keep it consistent, and roll with who you got. But yeah, so I think Amarius, I mean, you've got a lot of future Sunday guys up front, and I'll be danged if these guys go out there and perform like Georgia's offensive line has in years past. And they don't win the Joe Moore Award. There's something up. There's something going on. There was something fishy because, Lord have mercy, those boys deserve that award the last 2 years. They have shown it. They approved it. They've done everything they can to earn that reward, but freaking win it when it came to the end of it.
So it was funny, like before last season started, I remember somebody asked me, they go, what's our offensive line going to look like this year? Like I haven't heard much about it. I'm kind of worried about it. You know, we've had all these in the past years, we've had some issues and different stuff like that and everything. And I told them, this is probably going to be one of the best offensive lines you've seen at Georgia with Kirby Smart. Well, I'm here to tell you that this next season is going to, like, it's not a question. Like, it's going to be the best offensive line that you've seen at Georgia under Kirby Smart. And like you just said, if they don't win the Joe Moore Award, I don't know what to tell you, man. I mean, this, the talent that they have, and the, like, they've got multiple returning starters at this point, and the guys like Tate Ratledge, which is important to talk about because guess what? He was a starter last season before he lost his job after messing his ankle up. Or is that last season? I'm getting confused.
What are you talking? Wait,
Tate Ratledge, when he got injured.
Oh, that was Clemson year. That was 2021.
So that was 21. That wasn't even last year. Like, you got guys like him on the roster. See, that's how crazy this is. 2 years have gone by, and we've got this crazy lineup of offensive linemen and stuff like that. And, like, guess what? Like, that dude's still on your roster right now. He was a starter, lost it because of that and all that, everything. Like, he's going to be one of your starting tackles this year. It's going to be incredible to watch the, like, cohesive group that they put out there at offensive line, whatever five they put out there. And our boy Brooks Austin talks about how they might mix some things up. You might see people shuffle positions. You necessarily see them get to play because they just got some dudes that need to be on the field. So I'm just excited. I can't tell you exactly what the five is going to look like, but I can promise you that the five that they end up putting out there is going to be freaking insane.
Well, you know, offensive line depth can get real short real quickly. Now, they don't get hurt too often, but when it does happen, it can get real shaky real quick. There's kind of some worries there. this past year where it was like tackle health is a bit of a concern because you know you got Broderick and you know you got Warren and you have Amarius Mims, but that's all you kind of know right now. That's about as far as the depth goes. Whereas this year, we listed off 10 names in 5 seconds. There was too many to name. We could keep going past that. And I think Georgia does a great job in spring practice of getting looks at guys in different spots and a lot of different spots.
Yeah.
Even Cedric Van Pran has been rotating around a little bit, and they've been getting looks at like Micah Morris.
He's playing guard, yeah.
And other guys like that. Jared Wilson at center, they've been getting him looks at center. All of those things, that's a great thing. Just kind of rotating guys around because it's so valuable to have what you had with Jamari Sawyer where it's like, we can put you anywhere and we know you're going to get it done. We know what you can do for us. And that's why you were able to put him at right guard and put Broderick Jones in at left tackle and the national title quest and the national title game. Those are all good things to have. And I think Georgia does a really good job with that. I think Stacey Searles has been killing it so far at the offensive line because there's a lot of questions kind of when Georgia brought him back, you know, former Georgia guy back when Mike Bobo was there as well after Matt Luke left. But Stacey Searles, by all means, has been doing an impeccable job with that offensive lineman, and that's continuing. The development has looked great. The offensive line continues to look really solid. And again, it kind of goes back to this conversation. It seems like any conversation we have, all good things when you have a new quarterback coming in and starting to roll in and get his reps in and looking like you're going to be tabbing a new guy. So offensive line, really solid. Seems like we said that about every position that we break down throughout this series. It's like at the end of it, we're like, really strong. Georgia's looking really good at this position. Well, it's because you recruit at such a high level. Kirby Smart and those guys are getting it done every single year on the recruiting trail. They reel in top talent and they develop like nobody's business. And so all good things. But yeah, glad we were finally able to get offensive line off the board. We didn't postpone it this time and we just checked it off the mark. And I think we have about 5 more position groups to continue with this offseason. I can't remember which ones, but we still got plenty more people. So there's more position battles. And the good thing with spring now being underway is kind of like we did with today, where we can kind of tell you what's going on in spring practice, maybe where guys are being placed. We're going to get to that with the rest of positions, and we'll have more information about how certain guys are doing, maybe guys to look for. So I think we've saved some really good positions to discuss later on in the series that we'll get to discuss. And
yes, Zach, we will hit special teams. Yes, I promise.
Special teams being one of them, Zach, finding out who Georgia's place kicker is now that Jack Podlesny is off to the NFL. So that is one, certainly, that learning some spring intel a little bit about who's going in, who's getting it done, and who's nailing those 50-yarders. Those are all good things to know about what's going on in spring. So glad we can continue this series. And now we're going to switch over to a new one. We haven't done King of the Hill actually in a couple of weeks, but I thought that this week was a good one.
Too much stuff to cover in the past few weeks, man.
We have. We've had a lot of talking points. But there was a lot of – there was this news that broke – or not really news, I wouldn't say. But 247 releases this article or releases this ranking, whatever, that said that Neyland Stadium is going to be the most electric environment in college football this next season when Georgia goes to play them in late November. They play them on November 18th. So that's end of the season. So that means that – it very well could mean that Georgia's undefeated and Tennessee is either undefeated or with one loss being to like Alabama possibly. And that's the game that's going to decide the Eastern Division. So very well, a lot of build up to that game, pretty much the only must watch game on Georgia's schedule this year. So shaping up to be a really good one, but I don't necessarily want to talk about Neyland Stadium and the electricity that they'll have because they showed what they can do against Alabama last year. Holy crap, that place was off the chain. Things were popping. Goalposts were being thrown in rivers. Them suckers up there, I don't know what's in their brain or if there's anything in those brains, but when it comes to Tennessee football, boy, do they show up. But what I want to ask about this segment, because, you know, King of the Hill is kind of where we debate a little bit. We formulate opinions on things, is you and I both, we're like early 20s at this point, mid 20s, whatnot. So we've been to our fair share of sporting events, football games, baseball games, what have you. What is the most electric environment you personally have been in? Any sport, any time, any game, just your opinion. What has been the most electric sporting event that you have ever attended?
It's such a tough one because I have like a list of like 5 different games that I can remember off the top of my head that have been so electric and so crazy that at the end of the day, it comes down to like some of the best memories that you've had. Just for argument's sake of what we're talking about right now, the best environment that I've ever been inside of Sanford Stadium was the Tennessee game last season. It was the Tennessee. That was loudest. I've, like you just said, I'm in my mid-20s right now. I've been to a lot of Georgia home games. I've seen a lot of Georgia games in general.
We were there for the Natty and for the Ohio State game.
Yes, we were. I was in the stands for those games. So I've been there. And that Ohio State game was electric. Don't get me wrong when I say that. But Sanford Stadium got louder than I've ever seen it by a large margin. They were putting the decibels on the screen, and it was probably about 20 decibels higher than I've ever seen it get in Sanford Stadium.
Easily.
Ever. Literally ever. And I've gone to countless number of home games at this point. And it was just one of those things that, like, the rain started coming down, and I looked at my buddy that I was sitting with, and I was like, man, maybe that might kill the crowd a little bit or anything like that. Nope. Guess what? That's when the crowd got the loudest in the entire game. Nobody cared it was raining. Nobody cared about anything else. They got louder and louder for each raindrop that fell on them at the end of the day. And it was just – it was one of those things that, like, they had been talked about so much. Sanford Stadium wasn't loud enough. Tennessee was about to just run through Georgia. They were the best team. Eric Eng. They were the best team that we've had in college football. They were comparing them to 2019 LSU as being the best offense that they've seen in the history of college football going into this game. And guess what happened? They got shut down in the matter of minutes of that game. And it just, the environment was like unmatched. That's one of my best memories. I know maybe it's a recency bias. I've been to some really, really good Georgia Florida games in the past. I've been to national championship games of Georgia at this point. I've been to the playoff games where Georgia played against Ohio State. I did not get to go to the Rose Bowl, but my wife did and her family did. And that was, if I had been to that game, that might have been able to take the answer as far as the environment because of how crazy that was. But of the games that I've been to, there's just so many to pick from. It is a really hard answer to give.
Yeah, I was at the Tennessee game as well. I was in the student section, so I got the full taste of what that environment was like. Yep. And there was something special about every – because, you know, typically in a home environment, it's like the crowd doesn't really get into it until it's the other team's in third down territory, and the crowd's going to get rowdy for third down, and hopefully they get them off the field. But I'm talking about before every freaking snap of that football game in which Tennessee had the ball, that place was off the chain every single time. There was not enough rain that day to put out the fire that was lit in Sanford Stadium. I mean, that place was just ridiculous. Easily one of the best environments I've been in as well. Roots, you pointed out one that I have long been wanting to go get a taste for myself, and that's an Atlanta United game. I see the videos.
I'm glad you said that. I was about to say
that too. I see what's going on in Mercedes-Benz when Atlanta United is playing, and that looks freaking lit. What they got going on there.
I need to go so bad. Yes. I've never been.
I'm not even a soccer fan. I really don't care for soccer either, but I really want to go experience an Atlanta United game because watching like soccer fan environments in general just look like so much fun because everybody there is so passionate about it and they're so invested in the game. And so I definitely want to go and test it out for myself and see what's going on. So Atlanta United is definitely one. But so it really came down to two of them for me because I don't want to pick the same one as you. And I had a feeling you would probably pick the Tennessee one. I went to the Atlanta Braves versus the San Francisco Giants playoff series. I think it was like 2010, something like that. Bobby Cox's last year as the manager. And unfortunately, the Braves did lose that game. But playoff baseball is electric. Throughout all nine innings, every single at bat, every single pitch, you stand the entire game. It's a lot of fun. I know I was 10 years old when that happened or 11 years old or whatever I was. But I understood how big of a game that was and watching that game unfold and just realizing like to the last out Turner Field at the time. And that stadium was just freaking hollering and just itching for anything exciting to happen. And it was just buzzing the entire time. So that's definitely one of them. The other one, a few years back, me and my future and father-in-law went to the Atlanta Hawks versus the Milwaukee Bucks playoff game. And it was the game actually where Trae Young did not play. And so I was sitting there in the stadium like,
wow.
Well, Trae Young's not playing. This was probably a bad game to go to. But nonetheless, we sat there in that game, and Atlanta pulls off the win. Giannis Antetokounmpo actually ends up getting hurt that game, and Atlanta upsets them and wins that game. That State Farm Arena, when it's playoff time, that's another place that really gets going, and that's just a really fun place to be as well in a playoff environment. I had never been to a playoff basketball game, so being in there and just every single three that hit, every layup, that place was just going nuts every single timeout. So that was a fun experience as well. But so I've been lucky enough to go to a lot of good sporting events. Like I said, you and I both were at the Ohio State game and also at the national championship game. Mm-hmm. We got to experience both of those things. But yeah, I think it's really hard to top the Tennessee game.
I've been at some pretty like heartbreaking games as well too. Like I was at the 2018 national championship game against Bama after the Rose Bowl and stuff like that. And that one that I physically felt chest pain and everything like that. I was at, this would have been my answer. Had the Braves won in game five of the World Series, that would have been my answer. But I wasn't even in the stadium. I was in the Battery of Atlanta. Oof. And like, I went out there because that was the chance.
One of those psychos.
Yeah. It was the day after the Georgia-Florida game, remember? So it was I was in Jacksonville. I went to the Georgia-Florida game that Saturday, came back on Sunday, got home. My friend met me at my house, jumped in my car, and we went to Atlanta, and we went to the Battery. Ooh. And I was like, and when that game started off with an Adam Duvall grand slam, I thought I was about to be a part of one of the most like epic like stories of all time right there. And if they had won that game, that would have been my answer by far, because the Battery, like, I can't imagine how insane Atlanta would have been that night. Oh my God. Oof. How crazy it would have been. Like, gosh, they were talking about their, like, the thing, you know, obviously there was like 40,000, 45,000 fans in the stadium. There was like another 90,000 people in like the Battery and the surrounding stadium area. Like, that place was insane. But that probably would have been my answer had they been able to pull that game off. Well, they didn't win that one, but guess what? They ended up winning game six in Houston, with Soler hitting that nasty home run and all the good stuff that happened with it. So it ended up ending as a good story, but I was so close to having one of the most like epic stories of all time, just being able to be there, even in like outside the stadium for that game.
Yeah, winning at home would have definitely been better if they would have been able to win it in Atlanta. But for the sake of the Atlanta Police Department and all the homes and the property around the area and down at the Battery, they're probably glad that they didn't win it in Atlanta, because holy
– probably.
I mean, you've seen what they do to Athens when Georgia wins the national championships. I mean, Athens the next morning, that Sunday or that Tuesday morning after the national championship, whew, you better stay away from downtown, because there's a lot of – there's a lot of stuff that happened, and there's a
lot
of
cleaned up.
Footprints.
Needs to be cleaned up. Yeah.
Yeah. It needs a couple of days before you can go back down there and experience Athens downtown. But yeah, I thought that was a good segment. Interested to see what Neyland Stadium will look like at that point in time. Like I said, it'll be interesting to see what Tennessee's record is. Georgia looks like they are almost a shoe-in to be undefeated when that game rolls around, how their schedule looks. Really nothing too scary before that game, but you got to show up for that one. And as I said, Neyland Stadium, they'll pack it out when they need to. When it means something, when they finally have something meaningful to play for, those fans will show up and they will be loud. But Georgia might silence them real quick, as they have in prior years. So, but that's going to do it for this week's episode. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Hope you enjoyed the offensive line breakdown. Hope you enjoyed our opening segment. Those three questions that we talked about that Kirby Smart needs to answer this spring. Even though he's in year eight, there's still some things that you can learn about this football program, about Kirby Smart, even if he has two national titles to his hands. But like and subscribe if you haven't already. If you have stayed through this entire episode, if you are at the 47-minute mark with us still hanging, whether you're live or if you're watching us a couple days later, we appreciate you. We appreciate the support. We appreciate all the good people in the comment section that kept the conversation going the entire time. We love you guys. We're thankful for you people. We love the support. And Stoddard, you can close us out, brother.
As always, like he just said, love you guys. Thank you guys for commenting and supporting us. Make sure you hit that like button before you leave if you haven't already. But as always, keep it classy in the Classic City, and we will see you guys next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Classic City Sports. Take a second to subscribe, rate, review, and share with your friends and family. Feel free to reach out to the Classic City Sports Crew on Twitter with any topics you'd like discussed. You can reach out to Jeremiah at The Stodfather, to Jonathan at Dr_JWill, and make sure to follow at Classic City Pod for show updates. Check back next week for a brand new episode. In the meantime...
Express the sentiments of the entire world.